Good afternoon. I'm Betsy Cannon-Smith, class of 84, and I'm pleased to introduce Tekla Harms, professor of geology, to you today. It's a cool, windy day in Amherst, and we're experiencing some unseasonable temperatures, but we have, I promise you, a great lecture today. She'll be speaking to us on catastrophic volcanism at Shoshone Falls, Idaho, existential issues through the lens of geology. Professor Harms completed degrees from Bryn Mawr College, Queen's University, and the University of Arizona, and a National Research Council postdoctoral fellowship with the U.S. Geological Survey before joining the Amherst faculty in 1987. Her research centers around the evolution of mountain belts and the deformation of rocks caught in continental collision zones. Her expertise is in the geologic history of the North American Cordillera mountain range. She has worked in the field in the Brooks Range of Alaska, southern Yukon and northern British Columbia, eastern Washington, southwestern Montana, and the coastal range of California. At Amherst, Professor Harms regularly teaches the department's introductory principles of geology course, as well as structural geology and plate tectonics and continental dynamics for geology majors. Last semester, she taught a very popular course, the Geology of the Great American West. She's a fellow of the Geological Society of America and the Geological Association of Canada, and a member of the American Geophysical Union and the Association for Women Geoscientists. She has advised countless geology thesis students, and perhaps we'll have a few minutes to talk about some of her collaboration with students at the end of this talk. And a number of you are on the line who worked with Professor Harms in the past, so I hope you enjoy this special opportunity. To submit a question during the lecture, if you joined by GoToWebinar, please type a question into the question section. You may need to expand the control panel on the right of your screen in order to access that. If you're joining by phone, you can email a question directly to us at alumseries@amherst.edu. After Professor Harms' remarks, we'll try to get to as many questions as possible. Professor Harms, thank you for joining us today. Welcome.
Thanks, Betsy. I'm very happy to be here talking to you all today. I've looked at the list of attendees, and I know that many of you are former students. Hello to you all. I wish I could give you a shout-out by name, but the list is too long. I do have to say that this is a very strange setting for me, and maybe it's a strange experience for you as well. I think of teaching as a kind of a conversation, even a lecture is a kind of a conversation. And this is a strange setting for that to happen. I know that you're listening to a disembodied voice, and feedback has to wait until the end of the lecture, as it were. But I'm game to try new technologies, so we'll give it a go. What I want to do today is to take you to Shoshone Falls, which is outside of Twin Falls in southernmost Idaho. It is a fairly awesome landscape. It was much more awesome in the recent past before the Snake River that flows over the falls was dammed for irrigation purposes. Today, just a trickle flows over the fall compared to what flowed there before the damming. Spring melt season would put just absolute torrents of water into the Snake River, I'm told. In the 19th century, Shoshone Falls was considered the Niagara of the West. Many people thought it was comparable to Yosemite in terms of its potential for tourist attraction. But in fact, today, I don't want to talk about the falls themselves. I want to talk about the underlying geology in the falls, because the underlying geology records two very different periods. One about 15 million years ago, when the bedrock geology that the water flows over was formed, and one as recently as 15,000 years ago at the end of our recent ice age. In both of these time periods, the area would have had a much more awe-inspiring or even terrifying landscape than it has today. They would have been times when the geologic activity happening at Shoshone Falls would have far outstripped anything happening today in both scale and scope. So the first of these processes that I want to talk to you about has to do with the bedrock. If we step back a little bit and look at Shoshone Falls from a distance, you can see that the rock around Shoshone Falls, oh, I'm being adjusted. All right. I hope that's better. I'm going to back up just one step and say, if you look closely at Shoshone Falls, and this is one of Timothy O'Sullivan's 19th century photographs. If you look carefully at the falls, you'll see through the background across the horizon, there are layers of rock, and then another layer down here where the falls exist. And you can see that again in this picture, this through-going layer of basalt here, or excuse me, of rocks there, and another layer down here. Now, both of these layers are, in fact, volcanic flows. The upper one is a basalt layer. That's a very common extrusive or volcanic igneous rock. The one down below is chemically a little bit distinct, but still it's a relative of basalt. And each of these flows is about 100 feet thick. The falls themselves are 200 feet high, so the total that you see from the top of the canyon wall to the bottom here, oops, didn't mean to do that, is several hundred feet tall. Now that's really an astonishingly thick lava flow. It dwarfs by several scales of magnitude the kind of lava flows that would be coming out of the Hawaiian volcano today. And if we step back even further now, we'll see that these lava flows are part of a very large igneous province. It's outlined here mostly, I can find the cursor, in green. It's known as the Columbia Plateau Province here, and then down into southern Idaho it continues into the Snake River Plain, where the Snake River flows. So here's the Pacific Coast. The state of Washington is about this big. The state of Oregon, about that big. So this is a volcanic regime that covers half the state of Washington, more than half of the state of Oregon, and a large measure of southern Idaho. And what we learn by dating these volcanics is that they all poured out over the surface of the Earth in about 1.5 million years. There are older and younger lavas than that, but the bulk of the volume that was extruded came out in just a geologically very, very short time. Now, it turns out that there are other places like this elsewhere in the world. You can see that the Columbia Plateau basalts show up here as this red splotch in northwestern United States. There are several other large red splotches on this map, and they all represent very similar, very short time period, massive volume outpourings of basaltic lava. And they're distinctive enough that geologists have given them a name. They're called large igneous provinces, which is known in the business as a lip. So the Columbia Plateau basalts are indeed a lip. The kind of basalts that are in these provinces are well understood, well known, and they're forming actually constantly as part of the regular plate tectonic process in the Earth. That is the basalts, not the large igneous provinces. So here's a diagram that just means to show what happens during mantle convection that drives plate tectonics. So the mantle is solid rock. It's heated from below by the heat from the core, and that means that the rock in contact with the core is hotter than the rock elsewhere in the mantle. Because it's hotter, it's expanded. Because it's expanded, it's less dense. And because it can flow in the solid state, much like silly putty does, it convects. So you see here an upwelling convection current of mantle flows along the surface, dragging a plate with it. And as it does so, it cools and then goes back to the outer core to warm again. That's an ongoing convection cycle that's happening all around the Earth in many places today, and it's a fundamental part of Earth dynamics and plate tectonics. A small byproduct of this convection and moving of plates is that as the mantle upwells, the pressure on the mantle is relieved. And this is very much like taking the cap off a soda bottle that you've shook. As that pressure is relieved, the mantle on its way up undergoes a little bit of melting. And that little bit of melting is the basaltic melt that comes up typically at plate boundaries, coats the ocean floor, makes ocean crust, which is, in fact, returned to the mantle again during subduction. So this is a kind of an ongoing cycle. At typical plate boundaries, that basaltic outpouring of lava is slow, steady, and under the ocean, where we don't see it on continents. But a large igneous province, while it shares this basalt, shares similarities, must occur in a somewhat different way. So on the top here, you see just a schematic diagram that's meant to show what we think is happening at a large igneous province. In this case, something happens to perturb that regular convection system that's part of plate tectonics. And the perturbation causes a plume of hot mantle to rise from the core mantle boundary. It rises faster than the rest of the mantle is moving. And it rises as a point source, as a fountain almost, coming off the core, all the way up to the surface underneath the plate, and in fact burns a hole through the plate that it's rising below. This diagram in the lower right is actually the result of mathematical modeling here, meant to constrain some of the parameters around this kind of mantle flow. And you can see that scientists are able to enter parameters into a computer and end up with a kind of plume that mimics the results that we see at the surface and gives us confidence that this indeed is what's happening in order to make a large igneous province. So there's upwelling mantle, hot mantle. As it comes up towards the surface, it's losing its pressure, just as we talked about in mantle convection. And that loss of pressure allows some of the mantle to essentially boil off fluid, boil off melt, and that melt erupts through the surface. And what's different here is simply the volume of melt that's produced. And the place that it's produced is produced within a plate, under a continent, rather than at a plate boundary. So this is what we think happened 15 million years ago under Western North America, to produce the massive outpouring of lava that is underneath the falls at Shoshone Falls. So we see this massive layer here below at the falls, and then up above, stretching across the horizon, this huge outpouring of lava. Now the next thing that I want to discuss about Shoshone Falls is actually a much more recent event and a surface process that was acted on that basalt layer. It's a consequence of the end of the recent ice age. You can take a step back now from Shoshone Falls, and what I want you to see is its setting. I can find the cursor. Here we go. Here's Shoshone Falls today, and you can see that it's in this much larger canyon where the walls are much wider than the river takes up today. And it's that aspect of the falls that is a consequence of events that happened at the end of the ice age. So at the end of the last ice age, the climate in North America was much wetter than it is today. And as a consequence, there were very large lakes in the continent that no longer exist. These are known as glacial lakes. And the one that I want to focus on today is this one here, which is in the position of Great Salt Lake today, but very much larger, and is known as Lake Bonneville. But it's very similar in character to what some of you may remember as Glacial Lake Hitchcock, that filled the Connecticut River Valley here also during the retreat of glaciers. That's another glacial lake that persisted about as long as Lake Bonneville did out here. Lake Bonneville was a very, very large lake. It was probably about as large as Lake Michigan is today. Now, Lake Bonneville was dammed at the northern end of the lake at its outlet. It was dammed by a natural pile of sediment, a natural earthen dam. And at some point, about 15,000 years ago, the lake level rose high enough in order to overtop the dam and to flow out into what is the Snake River today over the top of the dam. But as it did so, the velocity was great enough that it actually eroded the dam away. And that resulted in a catastrophic emptying of Lake Bonneville all at once. Now, we know that Lake Bonneville existed, this very much larger lake existed, by looking at the shoreline around Great Salt Lake today. What you see here is a view of a place known as Antelope Island. And you'll see stretching across Antelope Island a series of parallel benches. The highest one is right up here. Those are actually wave-cut benches cut by the shoreline of the lake when it was at a much higher level than it is today, proving that Lake Bonneville used to fill more of the valley and be a larger lake. This is a similar image from farther south in the area, but also along the shores of Lake Bonneville. You can see again a wave-cut bench here, another wave-cut bench there, a third one here. In fact, probably some of you will remember seeing those same kinds of wave-cut lake benches on the shores of Lake Hitchcock. They can be felt as you go down Route 9 from Amherst College towards the playing fields. There are several little interruptions of the hill slope that we recognize as lake benches. So we know that the lake was there. We also know that it emptied catastrophically. by flowing north into what is the Snake River plain today. So going back again, now this is a Google image look at Shoshone Falls. Shoshone Falls is right there. And I want you to see that the present Snake River runs through a very much larger river valley or river gorge than the Snake River occupies today. And we believe that that larger canyon was cut during this catastrophic emptying of Lake Bonneville, so that huge volumes of water and highly erosive water flowing at extreme velocities came through that canyon and carved it essentially instantaneously. We can see features along the modern Snake River that we recognize as river cut features, similar to river cut features on regular rivers today. But once again, what we don't recognize about them is their scale. Their character is the same as we would expect from rivers today, but their scale is completely out of proportion to what rivers do in the world today. Besides this larger channel, this is another Google Earth image along a little bit downstream along the Snake River. You can see the Snake River flowing from left to right here. And it's this alcove here that I want you to look at. It's known for these two lakes that are in it called the Blue Lakes. I find it humorous that today it's home to a large golf course. You can see here because there's water nearby to irrigate the golf course. But look at this escarpment here that's at the head of the Blue Lakes. That escarpment would have been carved by water flowing over the top of the lava flows, cutting erosively in through this lava bed and then emptying again down where the rest of the Snake River flows. So the volume of water at the time was sufficient to cover this whole plains area and then to flow down and erode out these what are now dry alcoves, alcoves without waterfalls. They would have been giant waterfalls at the time. If we look downstream from these areas, where that floodwater would have emptied as it emptied out of the canyon, we see these remarkable plains that are covered with these large, these are called melon gravels. They're boulders, rounded boulders the size of melons, watermelons, cannonballs. And this all represents the debris that was scoured out of those canyons that we saw, carried by river water at tremendous velocity, and then dumped as that water spread out over the plains below the falls. So all of this is evidence of the existence of Lake Bonneville, of its catastrophic emptying, and of the effect that it had on carving the canyon that the Snake River flows through today, making it Shoshone Falls. This is a beautiful aerial photograph of Shoshone Falls taken by Michael Light, who's the class of 86, a photographer in San Francisco, who very generously gave permission to use this slide. And you can see here a number of the features we've been talking about. The Shoshone flows from the Snake River flows from the upper left to the lower right over Shoshone Falls here. But you can see that a portion of the river once flowed through this canyon here, did not downcut as far as the main flow, but filled this whole area left to right through that canyon, came over the falls and carved out the falls and continued along its catastrophic flow. So Shoshone Falls records two episodes of outsized geology, geology occurring on scales and across areas that it doesn't typically conduct itself on a day-to-day basis. And that's part of what makes the falls so interesting to me. That is that they've been a matter of interest to geologists for quite some time in trying to reconcile the geology that they see. Shoshone Falls was important to geological thought in the late 19th century, after the Civil War, when the U.S. was exploring its lands, and it did so with four great surveys, two of which I want to link to Shoshone Falls today. These surveys were led by giants in geology. On the left, the person that you see there is Clarence King. He led a survey along, essentially along the 40th parallel, but it took him to Shoshone Falls. On the right, you see John Wesley Powell, another giant in geology, a giant of an explorer. And his exploration was the drainage of the Colorado River and through the Grand Canyon, one of the first people to boat the entire Grand Canyon. Both of them developed ideas about how geology works, about geological processes that are still used today. And they developed these ideas to explain the geology that they saw along the way on their campaigns. But as a consequence, each of them held positions that were antithetical one to the other. Powell witnessed a violent rainstorm while he was in the Grand Canyon, and he watched as that violent rainstorm, something back in my Arizona days we would have called a gully washer, he watched as that rainstorm washed pebbles down the canyon walls and into the Colorado River below. And from this, he concluded that the whole canyon of the Colorado, the whole Grand Canyon, was produced by those kinds of everyday processes happening little by little over vast periods of time. And he was, in fact, correct about that. But King saw different geology on his survey, and he saw it very differently. When he went to Shoshone Falls, he saw the vast basalt flows covering the landscape as far as the eye could see. And he also saw the vastly outsized canyon that the Snake River flows through, one that's much larger than the present Snake River could ever carve. And he determined from that that both of those features were made by processes quite unlike those that are operative today. Now, Powell's view of the Earth, one that is produced little by little by processes that we can go out and witness today, is known in geology as uniformitarianism. That is, a uniformity of process today and yesterday forming the rocks that we see. Whereas King's view of the world was one that we call catastrophist. He saw that catastrophic scale processes must be important in forming the geology that we see today. At the time, these were seen as fundamentally important views, and they were seen actually as world views, as views that informed people about their place in the Earth and the makeup of the Earth. At the time, these geologists understood what they were doing, and their peers understood that what they were doing with their science was to reach back to try to understand the time of creation. They were reaching back to see the acts of God more clearly. But between the two, you have to ask, what kind of creation and what kind of God? What King saw when he looked at Shoshone Falls and the geology around the Shoshone Falls was power, grandeur, but also a good deal of terror. And I just want to make clear that in my reading, that's what King perceived of the world because specifically he fully understood the geology that he was looking at. Now, King wrote a very famous book called Mountaineering in the Sierra Nevada. It was a book written for lay people. And it was written in romantic and florid language, not really a scientific tome at all. Powell was much better known for his dry scientific contributions. But this is part of what King had to say about Shoshone Falls in the passages in Mountaineering in Sierra Nevada. It says, "On the approach to the Shoshone, you ride upon a waste, the pale earth stretched in desolation. Suddenly you stand upon a brink as if the earth had yawned. Black walls flank the abyss. Deep in the bed, a great river fights its way through labyrinths of blackened ruins and plunges in foaming whiteness over a cliff of lava. You turn from the brink as if from a frightful glimpse of the inferno." So, okay, that's pretty flamboyant. That's pretty florid language. It was written for lay people. But he was trying to express to lay people the impression that geology left upon him about how the earth works. I much prefer a much longer, drier, and more scientific paper. It was an address that King gave to his alma mater, Yale, in 1877. And he makes arguments there for catastrophism and against what he calls radical uniformitarianism, the idea that nothing could have happened on the Earth other than what we see happening today. And in that, he has the line, "Sweeping catastrophism is an error of the past. Radical uniformitarianism, however, persists and probably controls the faith of a majority of geologists and biologists." King was a proponent of seeing that the Earth history was probably punctuated by events unlike those that we know of today. And I think today most geologists have an opinion that stands somewhere between King and Powell. I think most geologists would call themselves uniformitarianists, but we recognize that today's Earth is just a snapshot of the Earth. It captures only some of the things that the Earth can do, and it's the rock record that gives us a more complete view of all the things that can happen on Earth. So I just want to conclude with King's thought on the screen now, and to repeat that King and Powell and the society of the day saw geology as informing their knowledge about fundamental questions about the nature of existence and the nature of creation. Neither King nor Powell nor their colleagues of the day were threatened by that knowledge. And what's curious to me and profoundly troubling is that that's a very different circumstance than the present antagonistic relationship between geosciences and fundamental religions today. I find that fundamental religions have to erect parallel and non-scientific theories, such as creationism or intelligent design, as sort of a defense against geologic knowledge, which I think is troubling and serves us poorly. With that, then, I'll stop my remarks and throw it open to questions.
Thank you. So our first question, Tekla, is not a question so much as a somewhat amusing remark from Jason, who in responding to your description of Clarence King and talking about that, writes, are you sure he wasn't describing a trip to William?
A horrible abyss, such as it is.
Thank you for that, Jason. So we'll start with just a few of the things that will shed a little bit more light on this very interesting discussion. Thank you. And I think we all want to go to Shoshone Falls now. At least I do. So one person writes, I noticed that Yellowstone is just east of Shoshone Falls at the Idaho-Wyoming state line. Is there a relationship between the geologic activity at Yellowstone today and the volcanic activity at Shoshone Falls, for those of us visiting the West and Yellowstone this summer?
That's a great question. Yellowstone turns out, we believe, to be the evolution of the plume that caused the large igneous province. I'm going to, if I can, back up a long way. We understand that plumes start with a very large plume head and size of that plume head that causes the large igneous province. That plume head is followed by this long sort of salamander-like tail, and that tail becomes the source of a hotspot like the Yellowstone hotspot. So we think that the volcanic activity at Yellowstone is being driven by the subsequent rise of this tail that comes along at the end of the hotspot. Yellowstone is similar in chemistry and origin, and it's very, very big, but not as big as the plume that caused the large igneous province in the first place.
So if you were to plan or suggest to someone who wanted to get a glimpse of the kinds of things you're talking about, of course Shoshone Falls is high on the list, and Yellowstone, it's all set up. But what are the other places that you'd suggest that people may be a little off the beaten track or wouldn't think of going to visit?
Well, between Yellowstone and Shoshone Falls, there is a national monument known as Craters of the Moon. And Craters of the Moon records a very youthful lava flow, as young as Yellowstone, along the track between the large igneous province and Yellowstone, and formed in a similar way. But because the climate is so arid in that part of southern Idaho, there's almost no vegetation in this lava flow at all. And so you get an opportunity to walk over and see all the components of a major lava flow in front of you. I caution you, lava is black, the summer is hot. This can be a very hot walk in the middle of the summer. But you can see lava tubes and lava caves and cinder cones and splatter cones and really a remarkable array of volcanic features, as well as the ones that you see at Yellowstone. Much heavier vegetation at Yellowstone, harder to see the volcanic features, even though you can see the geothermal features.
But maybe less crowded.
Almost always less crowded, and definitely off the beaten track. You should pack a little picnic lunch because there isn't much around there except lava.
Well, that's our travel tip of the day. Could climate change cause similar catastrophes today?
Well, that's a very good question and one that I have to parse a little bit. I often tell my students in intro geology that should we do the worst, which we are on a track to do, and melt all of the polar ice, that will raise sea level an estimated 10 to 20 meters, which on the scope of things is actually very small. It won't greatly reconfigure the Earth. It won't leave much of a record in the rock record. But should we raise sea level that high, fully one quarter of the human population will be displaced from where they live today. So I guess I would consider that a catastrophe. It's not a catastrophe, a geologic catastrophe. It won't be significant in the rock record, but I think it's something to be avoided at all costs.
Thank you. Julie writes, was there a time period when lip emplacement was common? How similar in age are the lips you showed on the world map?
Hey, Julia, how are you? No, to my knowledge, lip emplacement is not synchronous. It's punctuated in Earth history. But you'll be interested to know that there is a fairly high correlation between lip emplacement and mass extinctions in the rock record. It does appear that the volume of volcanic outpouring puts enough particulate matter into the air and enough chemicals into the air that it is a major degrading factor on the environment and probably was contributory to a number of extinctions. So you'll see them happening at the, the Deccan Traps happen at the end of the Permian. The large igneous province that's associated with the rifting of the Atlantic happens at the end of the Triassic extinction. So the synchronicity is not between lips, but between lips and the other geologic factors that they influence.
Great. Another question from John. What is the relation of the Idaho batholith of the Sawtooth Mountains to the flows that created Shoshone Falls?
Oh, John, none whatsoever, I'm sorry to say. The Idaho batholith is an intrusive that is about 100 million years old. It relates to the phase of mountain building that built the backbone of the Rocky Mountains. And so that's quite a bit older than this very young, large igneous province that's kind of superimposed on the regional geology.
And here someone says, I may have missed it, but did you say time scale over which the, the Columbia basalts were extruded?
Hey, Alex, this is like a geology reunion here. The Columbia basalts were extruded between 17 million and about 13 million years ago, but 95% of them came out 15.5 million years ago. So I would say an easy round number to remember is 15 million years ago.
There you go, 15 million years. Thank you. These are great questions. I think Professor Harms feels like she's in class now. I believe some of the lava tubes and craters of the moon were used to store food that was sold to settlers using the Oregon Trail. Do I remember correctly? From James.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that I have been in those lava tubes in the middle of July on a hot day, and they're incredibly cold. So it's not hard for me to imagine that they were used as an early form of refrigeration. They would do quite nicely. And you don't have to go very far into the tube to need to put on sweaters and jackets, even on a hot July day.
And David asks, the debate between King and Powell occurred over a century ago. Are there similar disputing views in geology today that speak to the fundamental nature of existence and are as yet unresolved? From Zurich, this comes.
It comes from Dave. I think, Dave, we geoscientists have retreated a bit from the public eye and now have many conversations among ourselves about how the Earth works. That we don't connect as directly to existential questions about man's place in the world. But I think we're being shaken from that that slumber or that sort of isolationism because of the need to interact with people about climate change and what that will do to Earth processes and to man's position on the Earth. Climate change will fundamentally distort how the Earth works and how we know it, at least in terms of surface processes. So I think we're about to re-engage in those kinds of discussions, and they will be discussions about what is the appropriate role that man has in controlling nature and affecting nature.
Okay, Becky writes, Tekla, would there have been large and or frequent earthquakes associated with the flood basalt extrusion?
You know, Becky, I don't know any way to check in the rock record to see if that would be the case. You raise a very interesting question. It's hard for me to imagine that much volcanism would not have generated earthquakes, but I suspect they would have been like Hawaii's earthquakes, which are frequent and very small, as opposed to the kind of earthquakes that would be large enough to create underwater landslides, the kind of thing we might find in the rock record and thereby make a correlation.
Is there a correlation with the Shoshone Falls cataclysm and the Lake Missoula cataclysm on the Columbia from Paul?
They are exactly comparable in nature and in outcome, but they come from two different lakes. So there was a catastrophic emptying of glacial Lake Missoula that came down the Columbia River, and a catastrophic emptying of Lake Bonneville that came down the Snake River. But both leave behind very, very similar features. Both flow across the same kind of basalt plateau, so they end up leaving very, very similar features behind.
So Julie writes, is there a difference between the plume that produces a lip and the plume that produces a typical hotspot like the one under Hawaii?
Well, if this room were filled with geologists, there would be, the debate would go on well past midnight in answer to that question. But since there's only me here, I'm going to give you my answer. And that is that it's probable that a plume head, a large plume, diapiric plume head, causes the flood basalts, and then the trailing tail behind that plume head causes what we understand better to be a hotspot.
Carl writes, it sounds like the emptying of Lake Bonneville was similar to the erosion caused by Brett's floods of ice-blocked glacial lakes in the Washington State's Badlands. Was the scale the same?
So, Carl, that once again, Brett's floods in the Scablands were the emptying of glacial Lake Missoula. The emptying of Lake Bonneville didn't spread out over as wide an area as the water that came out of Lake Missoula did. It was more confined. So in that sense, it's not quite the same scale. Another difference is that Missoula appears to have emptied, been blocked again, refilled, and emptied maybe even a dozen times. And that's because it was blocked by an ice dam. So as climate fluctuated and the ice dam formed again, the whole cycle repeated itself. But for Lake Bonneville, once it tore through its own sediment dam, the lake level dropped catastrophically and really was never the same again.
From Robert, can the velocity of water during the event be determined from the size of the boulders you showed us on one of the slides? If so, what was the velocity of the water during the event?
Darn, that is a good question. I suspect somebody smart could do that. I don't know that someone has. I haven't found something in the literature about that. And I wouldn't want to do it myself. But let's leave it at really, really fast.
That's a good answer. Can any of the movement along the Teton Fault be attributed to the regional volcanic processes of similar age?
Hey, Phil. The Teton Fault is a normal fault. You'll remember what that means. And that's probably associated with the expansion caused by the Yellowstone hotspot. So as North America moves relative to the hotspot, and new positions for the hotspot are taken up, the crust domes up from the heat, from isostasy, and that Teton Fault is one of the normal faults. It's a consequence of that doming.
We have an earthquake question, which we seem to ask Professor Harms to talk a lot to our alumni groups about. But to that question, the catastrophic release of Lake Bonneville also caused several earthquakes, although presumably more proximal to the lake itself. That is, may have caused the earthquakes. Could you comment on that?
Cece, I don't know the answer to that. I think that might be a very good study to do. You could probably do some trenching in Lake Bonneville sediments to see if there are the kinds of liquefaction features that are commonly associated with earthquakes. I just don't know. I'm not aware of any studies that have done that.
I think there's some work growing out of this conversation here. Do any of these geologic formations and plumes present hazards to oil and gas development? From a poli sci alum working in oil and gas in Denver. Thanks, Matt.
I've got to think about that for a moment. Oil and gas development takes place over a very long, slow, steady time frame. And as you probably know, it takes place in a particular thermal window. If you exceed that thermal window, if you make the crust hotter than that, you boil off all the usable petrochemicals and there's nothing left. So to that extent, you really want to develop your hydrocarbons in an area not associated with massive amounts of volcanism. It really is, there's so much volcanism on the Colorado Plateau that no scientist can tell you what underlies all of that basalt. So if some of the hydrocarbon-bearing strata that we find to the south in Wyoming and in Colorado, if those once were up there, we're not going to get at them now, that's for sure.
Tekla, this one's from Alan and Ben. What is the proposed mechanism by which lip eruptions cause mass extinction? Is it the sheer amount of aerosols emitted and with that relatively low atmosphere input end up spreading worldwide?
Hey, guys. How are you doing out there? You probably know the answer to that better than I do. I think the assumption is that the eruption puts not only aerosols but greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, sulfur in particular, and that the instantaneous volume is so high that it takes quite a while for the atmosphere to equilibrate or to recover from that input. But I don't know of any studies that have actually demonstrated a linkage. I don't know, most lips are old enough that we're not going to capture gas bubbles in glaciers or anything like that where we might actually sample the atmosphere of the day.
Okay, and we'll keep moving. Great questions. Do all hot spots have an associated flood basalt, in particular the Hawaii hotspot chain?
No, they're not. So, Aaron, the answer to that is that there are plumes and then there are plumes, and that's the reason for so much debate on those plumes.
Are there any examples of East Coast plumes?
So I just need to say hello to Chris White, who's sending in that question. I'm not sure how Chris got involved in this, but I wanted to say a particular hello to him. There is an East Coast plume. We think there's something called the White Mountain Plutons that occur in a line. I'm not much of an Appalachian geologist, but they occur in a straight line through New Hampshire off the East Coast and appear to connect up with a series of seamounts in the Atlantic Ocean. It's not an active hotspot, but the assumption generally is that is the result of a hotspot track.
Is it known whether there were pre-existing geological or topographical features that would have promoted the placement of Lake Bonneville and or Lake Missoula? Oh, sorry, going on to a second question. Go ahead.
Well, Lake Bonneville and Lake Missoula are in big valleys, and the big valleys are contained between mountain ranges that were formed during the Rocky Mountain phase of mountain building. So in that sense, the faulting that produced the mountains is contributory to trapping the basins, and that's inevitably where water ends up, is in the lows. But I don't think I have a more complicated answer than that.
Now our alternative theory question. I heard there's an alternative theory for Yellowstone activity and Western Plateau, rather than a hot spot, that it's related to a subductive slab with really weird geometry. Could you explain that or suggest a reference or person I could contact to learn more?
Julie, I'm not even going to come close to explaining that because I don't buy into it myself. But if you send me an email, I would be happy to send you a couple references that you can read up on.
Okay. Tekla, could you talk to us a little bit about some of the work you've done with some of the students and perhaps some of your early years when you'd helicopter into some of the research areas where no car or plane or train could reach?
Well, some of those folks are on the line up there sending in questions, but I've had a really great career and have enjoyed those aspects of the career that take me out in the field immeasurably. Part of the fun of being a field geologist is the opportunity to go to settings and situations that you find pleasing, and I certainly do find mountains pleasing. So my career has taken me to the Brooks Range in Alaska, to the Rocky Mountains in Canada, and most recently now I've been working in Montana. Throughout my career, whenever possible, and that's almost always the case, I take Amherst College students with me during the summer to get the basic science done that they need to do their senior theses. So I've had now a I hesitate to say the numbers, but a 25-year career of taking Amherst students out to these locations in the field with me. And it's been very rewarding. It's been rewarding both just for the opportunity to get out there, but also for the insights that their work has brought to the train of research that I've been working on. It really is true that it's wonderful to take an innocent set of eyes out in the field. And by innocent, I mean ones not overwhelmingly persuaded by existing knowledge, because they have a tendency to, it's sort of like, you know, the emperor's got no clothes. They have a tendency to look at things as you explain them and say, no, I don't see that. And then you try and explain it again, and they say, no, I don't see that. And then you take a hard look at it yourself, and you say, you know what, it's not there. And then you kind of have to figure out de novo what is going on. So it's been very scientifically rewarding, but also personally rewarding to go out in the field with these folks.
And I'll ask you what's probably almost an impossible question to answer, but the fun in asking it, you've advised probably 40, 50 thesis students over your years here. Could you offer us a couple of examples of kind of the extremes of those, of that kind of work, sort of polar opposites of the thesis work that you may have been involved in, whether it's geographically distant and close or type kinds of topics?
Well, some of the people phoning in today have participated in this work with me. I was taken along as a sort of consulting geologist on a project that other Amherst faculty were running on one of the Greek islands, on the island of Syros. It's not a place that I would have by myself, my research would have taken me. But they needed my kind of geologist along and asked me if I wanted to spend a month on a Greek island. And I thought about it for about 30 seconds and said yes. So that's an example of serendipity in doing geology. It's one of the ways that your associations with colleagues and students can get you up in investigating geology that you, on your own, you probably wouldn't have taken yourself to see. But I have to say that I've been persistently interested in figuring out certain aspects of the history of the Rocky Mountains, and that's why I keep going back. So the constant in all of that is my failure to come up with the answer year after year after year, and therefore my necessity of going back. And if I don't mean to embarrass my present students, but if I use my present students as an example, I took four students, excellent students, out to Montana with me this summer. I had in mind several issues that if they focused on those issues, we could resolve them and piece together a coherent picture of the mountains. And we brought back the samples that we needed, and the students worked very hard, and I have to say that no answer has been forthcoming. What they've done is to better constrain what the problems are, to make clearer to me what we have to do the next time that we go out. But there again, we've learned a whole lot more about the mountains themselves, and what I consider to be the ultimate answer is still just beyond our intellectual fingertips. We have to go a little bit farther and do a little bit more, and darn it, I've got to go back to Montana.
And that gives four more students a chance to go with you.
Maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Would you talk a little bit about moving from the building move from Pratt to Benesky and how that's changed the kind of work that you are all able to do or how you do it? Being in a new facility that many of you probably didn't get the chance to work in.
If there are people out there who haven't come and seen our new facility yet, you must come. We're like pigs in poo in this new building, I have to tell you. I know that the folks who were seniors the year the new building was built were, we all had a very happy home and a very collegial relationship in our old building. And I know that seniors were concerned that moving to the new building would become somehow more antiseptic or less collegial. So I remember at one point we took them all over with hard hats and walked through the building while it was under construction. And they left that trip saying, can you finish it before we graduate? We want to move in. So we've been nostalgic for the old building, I would say, for some total of maybe 30 man seconds. And otherwise, we're just thrilled with the new building. It facilitates the kind of science that we're trying to do, especially for people who have rather sophisticated instruments and sophisticated labs. I don't count myself amongst them. I have a big hammer and a truck. But people who have sophisticated instruments find that the building really marries those instruments into the day-to-day thinking that goes on in the building. Rooms are set up to facilitate exactly the purposes in those buildings, in those rooms, excuse me. And of course, the museum has just taken on a whole new life. It serves much better to interpret the collections that we have and to bring science to more people, people in the Amherst community, but also people outside the college. So we're thrilled with that building. And I can only imagine that the new science building that will house the other sciences will have that feeling, except on steroids, that it will just be an incredible boost to the training and the learning and the science that's done at Amherst College.
Two more student-related questions. Could you speak a little bit about the geology as a major at Amherst and what you're seeing in terms of student participation in that? And second, the environmental studies major and how geology intersects with that.
So the geology major continues to evolve as earth sciences evolve. So there's much more in the geology major today that has to do with the surface of the earth, the hydrosphere, the biosphere, the atmosphere, than there was in the department when I joined it 25 years ago. We have new young scientists who are working in those spheres and doing very exciting work. We continue to teach the old classics, petrology, structural geology, sedimentology, but we've added to them this burgeoning part of the science that is more concerned with surface processes than the processes that I work on arise from deep within the earth. The new environmental studies major is peopled by partly geology faculty as well as biology, chemistry, and then people from the humanities. So we participate in that rather heavily. There has been a big rise in the number of environmental studies majors. They are commonly double majors. Many of them are double majors with geology. We haven't seen a decrease in the number of geology majors, as we don't see that people have shifted to environmental studies from geology, but more that they've added environmental studies on with geology. So our numbers of majors are about constant. We are a small but personal and family sort of oriented group of people, not prone to the masses. Enrollments in intro geology, in fact, have gotten much larger just because we've added more kinds of intro courses. So we now teach geology to a very large percentage of the student body. A quarter of the student body takes the regular intro geology course before they graduate, and add to that those who take about 75 people a year who take the intro environmental science course. So we're getting the word out. More people are recognizing that knowledge of the earth is a necessary part of citizenship and will be more so in the future.
So it's great. So a real increased exposure among the students to that. Here's another great question from our audience. The current antagonistic relationship that you mentioned between climate earth sciences and fundamentalist religions really concerns me. Do you have any thoughts about what scientists or education outreach people could do to resolve it?
Boy, we have to be vigilant. We have to do a number of things. We have to be willing to make a clear statement about what science is and get that word out, mostly because I think people who have a tightly held fundamental relationship to God are not going to be persuaded, and I'm not looking to change their minds about religion or about faith. But I do think that all citizens need to understand what science is and how science works and not to confuse the two. And that's where I think scientists can make real strides. In particular, scientists, active in science, know very well that we live with uncertainty all the time. Scientists have a very high standard for what certainty is, and so almost everything we do is within the realm of what we consider uncertainty. Not a one of us is going to say that evolution is proven. Proof has a very high standard in science. We need to do a better job of letting non-scientists understand that uncertainty is not seen as a crippling flaw for any theory, that the uncertain theories that we have describe the Earth very well and very accurately, are very useful in predicting what's going to happen and allowing us to prepare for what's going to happen. And so we hold them in high regard, these uncertain theories. uncertainty is a fact of deliberation and moving forward, and it's something that we can do a better job of letting people understand is simply a part of what we do. We also need to do a better job of letting people understand what scientific standards are. A lot of things that are put forward as pseudoscience, as science, are in fact pseudoscience, and they're not conducted with the kinds of testing and requirements for observation that real science entails. And I think we need to be better at getting that word out. I think if we do so, people will have much more faith in and much more buy into the things that scientists tell them, like the climate is changing, we need to do something about it. The fact that people don't believe us when we say that speaks to a poor job that we've done in explaining how science is done, what kind of observations it rests on, and what kind of confidence we have in the things that we say, despite the uncertainty.
Well, we're approaching the end of the hour. I want to thank Professor Harms for a really fascinating and interesting conversation. I think we'd all choose to spend a lunch hour or wherever you're calling in from this hour in this way. If you want to review the slides and hear this again, it will be posted on our website. And for those of you who get the chance to come back to Amherst, don't forget on the key alumni weekends throughout the year, we do have open classes, and our friends in the geology department are always among the people whose classes are open. So it'll be your chance to get back into the classroom. And I hope you enjoyed this hour. We were happy to be with you, and thank you again.
It's my pleasure.